Welcome to episode 6 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
No, I'm not talking. I'm far too traumatized.
And that is a very scared and horrified film watcher, Greg Ralph.
Horrified, that's right.
But we have been watching horror films, and this is our horror episode. Where we have, I've seen all three films, and Greg hadn't, and this is the sort of point in putting him out of his comfort zone here. So we started with...
Gee, thanks, Ricardo. All right, okay, so Ricardo had seen these three horror films. He knows that I hate horror films, so of course he had to make me watch horror films. And I've now conveyed the message from my wife that there are to be no more horror films in the future, Ricardo. Hello, darling. But we've watched them, and we're going to talk about them, just so I can get them out of my system, if nothing else.
Look, the first film we are going to talk about is Wes Craven's A Nightmare on Elm Street.
1984.
The next one we're going to talk about is... the 1996 film Scream.
Also by Wes Craven.
And then we're going to talk about the 2014 Australian film The Babadook.
Correct. So in each case, because I haven't seen these films before and because I don't want to overly dwell on them, Ricardo, you're going to tell us about each film to start off. So why don't you start with 1984's A Nightmare on Elm Street. Oh, naff off.
Okay, Nightmare on Elm Street. This classic 1984 slasher film, directed by the master of horror, Wes Craven, centres around some teenagers who dream of a man, Freddy Krueger, Robert Englund, who was forever typecast in this role. He's a burnt-faced man with knives for fingernails, who tries to kill them in their dreams. The only thing is, if he kills them in their dreams, he kills them in reality. Enter Nancy, Heather Langenkamp, a teenager with a drunk mother, Ronnie Blakely, and policeman father, John Saxon. Nancy also dreams about Freddy, and after a few terrifying encounters and deaths of some close friends, begins to suspect that a secret is being kept by the town's parents, who seem to know the real story behind the real-life Freddy Krueger. Featuring a very young Johnny Depp in his first film role, this film spawned many sequels, all of which I think are enjoyable, but really they became less and less scary and more comical and were taken over by special effects. But this film, apparently spawned by a dream of Wes Craven's, is still very scary and spine-tingling to this day. Watch it late at night and I guarantee it'll still make your senses heightened as you turn out the lights. Greg, okay, I know you're not a fan of horror.
And you have made it very clear I should review these films being at least a little bit open to the genre.
To the genre, absolutely. Yeah. So take what did it I away. Think? Okay.
Well, look, to coin a phrase, I think I'm a Craven coward.
Okay.
Because it took me a long time to even settle down to watch any of these films because I don't like them. I just don't like them.
Yes.
But when it started... And I got a bit excited by the opening titles because it said, you know, it had Rooney Mara, Katie Cassidy, who's David Cassidy's
Rooney
daughter.
Mara?
Yeah, David Cassidy's
not
daughter.
Rooney Mara, it's Blakely.
No, not Ronnie Blakely. Rooney Mara, Katie Cassidy and Connie Britton, who's currently in the TV series Nashville. I thought, oh, this is okay. And then I realised I'd actually bought the 2010 remake.
Oh, no! No!
So I had to put it away.
No, I've never seen that. I never will.
And neither will I, but I'll tell you why in a moment. So I put it away, and so I had a whole night off to go and buy the 84 version next day. And you know what? I think it sucks. And I think it sucks almost exclusively.
Oh, great.
No, because I think it's really hokey. It's not because it's a horror film. Well, not horror film in the sense of, oh, I'm going to be scared by it and therefore I can't. I just think it's so dated. I really do. Whereas, and a lot of it's got to do with special effects moving on. And I'll come back to that too probably. But
I think the effects,
from the first 10 minutes, the first 10 minutes of the 2010 film until I realised, I should have realised straight away, but I didn't. I don't want to watch that one because I suspect the special effects will be more realistic and I just don't want to go there.
No.
But in this one, I had so many problems with it. I thought that there were some good moments in it. I think the idea of the fact that, you know, in other horror films, you can try and get away. You can try and lock yourself out or in a room to escape. And you see that a bit in Scream, which we'll talk about later on as well. But this idea that, in fact, at some stage you've got to sleep.
That's right.
And when you do, watch out.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really neat concept. I don't know to what degree it's original because so much has happened since. I don't know if this has influenced those or vice versa, mm-hmm. but it is a really interesting concept. And some of the moments that were in the film, filmically, were really good. So the scene where Nancy is in the bathtub and the hand,
yes.
cord hand, comes yeah. up the first time mm-hmm. and then later the second time. And then when it pulls her down into the bathtub and it's like she's under an ice lake with the one hole of light above that she's trying mm-hmm. to get back to.
Yes.
I thought they were really good sequences.
Yeah.
I didn't find them particularly scary, but I thought they were, you know, well done. And I would have liked to have seen more of that. The bit when she's running up the stairs when she's asleep and the carpet on the staircase seems to be made of porridge. Yeah, I've seen things like that, but I still thought that worked well.
Yeah, I think all of those effects worked very well. I enjoy the effects because they are real effects. They're not computer generated.
Yes.
And to me that makes it a lot more real.
And the first death where the first girl whose name escapes me.
Oh, Tina.
Tina, yes, Tina, thank you. Because she keeps coming back and Nancy keeps saying, Tina, Tina. When Tina is killed in the bedroom and is kind of rolling around, struggling in the air, and then thrown up to the corner of the room.
Yes.
Which I thought, oh, maybe that's done by having one of those rooms that turns upside down. But meanwhile, the boyfriend is in the bottom right-hand corner.
Yeah, it's very well done.
It's very well done. And there's probably wires or something, but I couldn't see it and I didn't care. That I couldn't see it, and I thought that was very well done.
It was very well done.
But there was
drops down. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But there were other things where I just thought, oh, come on, really? I thought it was just so over the top and badly done. Part of that, I think, is a function of the age. So there are special effects in the film which they just don't look right. And I think as a result, they either look wrong and or the camera doesn't dwell on them so you don't notice that it's, you know, fake.
Okay, so...
But then I found it a bit hard to work out what I was supposed to be seeing.
There's one moment at the very beginning when we're in Tina's dream. I think it's Nancy, actually.
Walking down the laneway.
It's Nancy. And his arms are very long. It's very dark. See,
same for the Babadook as well, which again we'll come to.
Yes.
When they kept things very simple and suggestive...
Yes.
And like, you know, in the bathtub, very simple, suggestive and so on, it worked well.
It worked well, yeah.
But scenes like... even the scraping... The cutting across the chest of Tina, I think it was, which just looks so fake and looked fake.
Oh, it was very quick. I don't think it looks that fake.
No, you look at it, the chest, the skin just looks wrong.
Oh, okay.
And it reminds me of a lot of those horror films of around that period that often looked very, very fake. Mm. Or even like you think of the melting heads at the end of the first Indiana Jones film.
Of course.
They just look wrong.
Same sort of thing. But
when the mother gets pulled through the door.
That was the time of special effects. I mean, they were very good special effects back then. They were very good.
The good special effects is Freddy walking down the alleyway dragging his fingernails.
Mm.
It's Freddy's hand coming out of the bathtub. It's the very simple stuff.
Mm.
The stuff where he opens part of his chest and there's maggots or something inside there.
Right.
The bit where the mother gets pulled through the door.
Yeah, very good.
And it's quite obviously a dummy.
It is,
bad dummy.
It is a bad dummy, that's right.
They look so bad that the film to me becomes quite hokey. And the other part I really had problems with is, so Johnny Depp, so he made this film, I looked it up a couple of years before 21 Jump Street, which was his big launch.
Yes, it says, and introducing Johnny Depp in the title.
But I looked at him in that and think, is there something there that says to me, this is a star in the making? He was all right, I thought.
He was all right.
He was all right. He was nothing special.
Look,
but his
at
death,
the very beginning, I think
so,
he was just a
spoiler
good
alert, he dies. but his death made no sense to me.
Mm.
Because, and this is where I thought the last part of the film, the last maybe quarter of the film, just fell apart.
Mm.
Because one of the things I really, what I find spooky are films, no matter how fantastical they really are, films that feel like they're grounded in reality and have some kind of logic.
Mm-hmm.
So on that, in that respect, for me, Scream, particularly Babadook, are actually scarier films.
Mm.
But this just got silly. Like, you know, Nancy's got a second coffee maker hidden under the bed when her mother takes the first one out in the 80s. I don't believe that. And then she wakes up, but now her phone turns into a mouth and tongue when she's awake. And then she unplugs it, and then it still rings. Well, Freddy's always been a creature in dreams.
Yeah, that's right.
So what's going on here?
Well, maybe he pulled her hat out of the dream. Oh. So he's starting to come into reality, into her reality. Yeah.
And then when Glenn, the Johnny Depp character, dies and he's pulled into his bed, okay, that's within his dream, that's fine.
Mm.
But then this, like, geyser of blood comes spurting out all over the ceiling. I think
it's over the top, but it's still...
But then his mother sees it happen.
Mm.
His mother's not part of the dream, so why is his mother seeing this? It just made no sense. He hadn't But he hadn't been pulled out of the dream at that stage.
No, no. Well, his mother doesn't see Freddy.
No, but she sees...
the blood. Because that's happening in his bed.
She sees him pulled into his bed and the blood all comes spurting out. Sorry. No, I just sort of got...
It was just like the guy saw Tina getting up, going up the walls.
The effects on the person.
Yeah.
But not the effect on the bed and this geyser of blood. I'm sorry, it just made no sense to me. Mm. And so, for me, the latter part of the film, it just got silly.
Yeah.
And the one bit I really cannot make any sense out of is the very end of the film.
Is that
so, at the end of the film, they've defeated Freddy and it's all happy, and I'm kind of expecting it to go bad, because a lot of horror films do that. Like, the nightmare's not over yet. And I'm sorry, I think that's actually really clichéd even in 1984. But, so it's all lovely outside, it's sunny, the birds are chirping, so you know something's going to go wrong.
Yeah.
And the mother's there and she waves goodbye to her and she goes in the car and her three dead friends are in the car.
Oh, back again.
The car starts acting up.
Yep.
She gets driven off, so she's never survived,
the
basically.
The car is now Freddy Stripes.
And so she's obviously gone, but we know she comes back in the third film. So what's going on? Like, it just makes no sense.
Yeah.
And so I got really tired of it. So while I'm on a roll, I really like seeing John Saxon in something.
Yes,
I grew up when John Saxon was in anything on TV, basically, in a few films. I don't think he actually had a lot to do, but I just like seeing him in it. I thought the mother was dreadful. I thought she was appalling and, for some reason, curiously orange. I couldn't work it out. And
a bit orange, wasn't she?
I was thinking Donald Trump. But she, you know, the hair and the tan, whatever
and
it was.
And the drunk. Yeah, she made
It was all a bit, you know, a bit... easy writing, I thought. But then I found out that she was nominated, I think, for Best Supporting Actress in the early 70s for Nashville, Robert Altman's Nashville, playing a country and western singer. I thought she was appalling. I thought she was so bad.
Look, some of the acting isn't great. I still think Heather Langenkamp, but you don't really matter. I mean, when you're watching these movies, you expect a little bit of bad acting in them. I expect them in these sorts of films. But the thing is, I find this film is still very scary. And you're right. By the end, it just gets less and less scary as it goes along. But I still think the opening act and the opening sort of setup is still quite scary. I still think the boiler room is such a great location for Freddy.
I've probably seen too many things that have probably picked up on it since.
Yeah.
It's like many years ago, like in the early 80s, I saw Casablanca.
Mm.
And also in the early 80s, I saw Hamlet on stage. And there are things in there that were very groundbreaking that everyone copies since, so that when you see it for the first time or you're with other people who see it for the first time, people think it's a joke and they laugh. You know, so they see Hamlet and they laugh at Get Thee to a Nunnery and something rotten in the state of Denmark, or some of the things that I remember happened in the Maltese Falcon people were laughing at because they were groundbreaking in their time. But then they become cliched. And there's probably a bit of that going on here as well, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But no, the scariest thing in this film for me was my apprehension before I actually started watching it.
Right.
I think Tina's death was well done, you know, and it actually probably was scary. But that was about it.
Freddy is meant to be a bit hokey. Freddy is as a character.
He's really hokey.
Yeah, he's meant to be. I don't think that. I think that's a choice. In the series, as it goes along, it actually gets hokier and hokier. I think you'd be interested to watch. You probably won't want to watch this now, but skip the whole series, but just go to Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which is quite a clever film because Wes Craven's in it, playing Wes Craven. It's, after all, Heather Langenkamp is Heather Langenkamp. Robert Englund is playing himself. They are in LA, and suddenly Freddy is coming back in real terms, and Robert Englund's going, she's saying that I'm having dreams about Freddy and he's coming into my dreams, and Robert Englund's going, really? That's really weird. And so, and the film is happening as Wes Craven is writing this new screenplay and bringing Freddy back. So it's all through the screenplay. It's actually really clever.
I probably won't watch it.
It's clever.
You know what this film really reminded me of? Yeah, I think it's a product of its time, or maybe a captive of its time, 1984. This is when MTV was really taking off music videos. This really reminded me in parts of a music video of that era.
Yeah.
And what I would call, and I use the term very loosely, the triumph of style over substance. Mm. So I think there's a really neat idea in there. I think it starts well. And then I just don't think it executes well. And by the end, I wasn't scared. I was just
finished.
I was over it.
Yeah.
I wasn't interested.
Mm.
And because it also represents for me the worst of horror films. I don't like horror films for two reasons. I'm scared or apprehensive.
Yeah.
And or because they're just... I remember films from that period that I saw, you know, that was when home videos were really happening and so on. And a lot of films are going through, and I didn't necessarily see all of these, but films like Leprechaun and... And some I liked, like the first two Poltergeist films I really enjoyed. But a lot of them was just like, you know, it's the schlock and the... And now quite dated special effects.
It really is. The way why I love horror films, I grew up loving them when I was a teenager. It's the first genre I went to when I went to the video store was the horror section. And I saw everything. These Hills Have Eyes. I saw all of the, you know, the Howlings and the, you know, Near Dark. You know, I saw all of the horrors. I was just like, which one am I going to watch today? I watched Nightmare on Elm Street. I don't know how many times when I was... So to me, it's very nostalgic to me. I think every time I watch it, I really enjoy it.
But is it the film or is it the nostalgia?
I think it's a bit of both. Mm. I quite like the film. I think it's still well made and I still think it is quite chilling when you watch it late at night at 2 in the morning.
You and I can watch it now and I won't be scared because, you know, I know where the scary bits happen and and after a while for me, it's not scary. It's kind of like, oh, really?
Yeah, but I still think at 2 in the morning, even when I watched it quite late at night, because I always want to watch a horror quite late at night because it's like a ride for me. Horror films are like a thrill ride. Okay,
And you know, I don't like thrill rides either.
There we go. But I love it because I just go on a, I'll go on a ride and I get all scared, tense, and I'm going to close my eyes and, you know, and then I finish it and go, that was good. That was quite an interesting ride.
Well, I think it's a really good analogy for what this film is.
Mm.
And I don't seek that. I'm not interested in that. But also, I didn't feel it was well executed. Maybe for its time, but I look at it now for the first time, and it doesn't do much for me. With exceptions. And the one bit I did want to pull out is, you know, and I now understand a lot better, not only what you said about the latest Freddy film, but from watching Scream.
Yes.
Which is also Wes Craven. That there is... you know, he loves that kind of self-referential stuff.
Of course he does, yeah.
And there was a great bit where Nancy at one stage looks in a hand mirror and says, oh, I look like I'm 20. And she's meant to be 15, 16?
Yeah, 15. Yeah.
I looked it up. She was 20 when she made the film.
Yeah, okay.
So I like that little in-joke, but it doesn't make a movie for me.
Okay. What are you going to give this, Greg? I'm interested in this.
Well, I almost gave it a 4 out of 10.
Give me a break.
But then I thought, well, I gave Cabaret a 4.
Yes, don't.
So I gave it 3. I thought,
are you serious?
Yeah, Cabaret is better than this. I didn't like.
Well, but you can't compare Cabaret to Nightmare on Elm Street. I don't care about the score. You can't just go Cabaret 4. I'm giving Wes Craven's Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
But you know how I rate these films. You know what I think. Is this good? Is this bad? Okay, or good? And within that. Is it, you know...
3 out of 10? No. Yeah,
I think it's the upper end of not very good.
No, I'm giving A Nightmare on Elm Street a 8 out of 10.
An 8.
I think it's very well done. And I think of its time, it was very well done. And I still think now I can watch it. Yes, it is a bit dated. But I think that's the fun of it when you watch those sort of films now. It's a bit fun when you see the bit of hokey special effects here and there or whatnot. But it doesn't really matter. Because I still think the essence of the horror is great.
And you really enjoy it and like go back to it again and again. And maybe that's the true horror. Okay, so moving right along with our Wes Craven horror films. Ricardo, why don't you now tell us about Scream?
Okay. Directed again by Wes Craven, the 1996 horror Scream allows Craven to really poke fun at a genre he loves and at the same time give many chills to satisfy any horror buff. This very well-written film, penned by Kevin Williamson, is about a killer dressed as Ghostface on the loose in the little town of Woodsboro. This killer likes to taunt its victims with trivia questions on horror films before he dispatches them. As the town is coming to grips with a recent murder, enter Sydney Prescott, Neve Campbell, a girl just starting to come to terms with the loss of her mother a year earlier, who was brutally raped and murdered. And it doesn't take long till the killer is after Sydney and no one is spared in the process. The film was so successful that it spawned 3 sequels, all directed by Wes Craven, and now it has a television series as well. The sequels never really lived up to the original, though, which is very clever and at times quite hilarious. But when it's scary, it's quite chilling. Greg, what did you think of Scream? I'm interested because this is it's very different in terms of Nightmare on Elm Street. I think this is a very clever, clever film.
Yes, but I don't know that I would actually call this a horror film. I think this is actually a comedy horror whodunit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has the slasher killer character, Ghostface.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, that picks up on the horror stuff.
Yes.
But one of the charms of this film, and I think it does have some charms, is that normally you think of, you know, the killer as being this relentless force, like Freddy Krueger or Dracula or, you know, the Beast from the Black Lake and all those kind of things. They are relentless, and when they pick their prey, barring some, you know, some diversion, they get them, and they're very efficient killers.
That's right.
This killer is someone who's actually quite gauche at times.
Yes.
You know, trips and falls. Yes. Is knocked over by a flung bottle of beer.
Yes.
Is flailing madly with their knife through the gap between a door and a closet.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there are funny elements.
There are.
And some of the references to the fact that basically is a film,
mm-hmm.
and the characters never quite say they are characters in a film. In fact, they say the opposite. Mm-hmm. But you know that the characters are saying that as characters.
Yes.
I found it a bit overlaboured,
mm-hmm.
and we can again come back to that. But I enjoyed the comedy part of it. I don't like things, you know, stabbing people and so on, but it was quite restrained. And this film, I don't think anywhere relied on special effects. It was
not really,
naturalistic. And I think that creates, at times, a sense of foreboding.
When this came out, a lot of the stars in this movie were not really stars at the time. Neve Campbell wasn't a star.
Courtney Cox was doing Friends,
Courtney Cox was...
I don't think David Arquette was very well known.
No, not at all.
Neve Campbell had come off Party of Five, the TV series, but wasn't... And it was making a few films. Either side of this, she would have made Wild Things.
Skeet Ulrich was still doing things, but he wasn't...
But is he well known now?
Well, he was at the time, because he was in As Good As It Gets. He was, in, you know, he did a few things after
Matthew
that.
Matthew Lillard, who plays Shaggy in Scooby-Doo.
In Scooby-Doo.
And still does the voice for Shaggy in the Scooby-Doo cartoons. And I like him as an actor. I find him very charming,
but
too.
But Drew Barrymore was a very big draw card to this movie when it came out in 96. I distinctly remember going, wow, Drew Barrymore is in this movie.
And I think it's not a huge spoiler to say she's gone in the first 12 minutes.
There's some spoilers in this which we're not going to give away.
We're not
going to
talk about who Ghostface is.
No, definitely not. But, you know, if you don't know that Drew Barrymore gets it in the first, you know, 10 minutes of this film, you know, I don't know where you've been hiding. but
And that first part, as it's...
But
it's,
did you know that? Did you know that?
Yeah, I did know that.
You did? There we go. That opening sequence is so well done. The film struggles to come up from that. It does. I mean, it does, and I think it's a good movie. But it
shifts, because the opening is pure horror, and then it shifts into this other, I think, mixed genre, which is horror, comedy, and whodunit.
Yes.
Now, I don't actually think it's a very good whodunit.
Oh, I don't think either.
I think the identity of Ghostface
is really
obvious for two reasons.
Yeah.
One is a physical reason.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it super obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And the other reason that I can't go into on air is that they use a very old Agatha Christie trick. And I grew up reading Agatha Christie. I watch Agatha Christie things. I watch Midsummer Night and all that.
Yeah.
So to me, it was really, really obvious. So, I mean, in fact, it was so obvious, I thought, oh, maybe that's like a red herring.
I think it's
a deeper twist, and there just wasn't.
I think it's meant to be the point as well, though. I think it was meant to be not too, like, so much a whodunit. I think you're meant to go, oh, it's obvious that it's that person. But when they question it in the film, when the other people are talking about horror movies and they question who would do it and who has done it and, you know, what happens in horror movies and the whole cliches of horror movies, you start to question yourself going, well, they're right and I would be going for that person and thinking that person was doing it, but that is too obvious. What about the other person? So you start thinking, even David Arquette at some point, you see... You know,
so how many of the Scream films have you seen?
I've seen three.
All right.
Yeah.
Are you holding on to your seat? I watched Scream twice.
Yes.
And I'm halfway through Scream 2.
Oh, wow. Well done.
Yes. Now,
amazing. You actually did that.
Well, let me tell you why I watched Scream twice. Do you remember last season when we talked about The Bicycle Thieves?
Yes.
And I was railing about the poor quality of the subtitles and that made me feel like I couldn't enter into the film?
Yes.
The problem I had with this film the first time I watched it is I watched it at home, my wife's gone to bed, so I turned the sound down because I don't want to wake her up.
Yes.
And the problem is that the volume of a lot of the spoken dialogue was much softer than the loud sound effects of, you know, nervous sounding music or, you know, slashing kind of moments.
You watched it with the sound down?
Down. And so I thought, oh,
but that's, hang on a minute. Hang on. That's a big thing. Because the sound is like a dimension of the movie. You can't, it's like having Psycho without the music.
No, but I could hear it.
Yeah.
But the problem, I didn't want
to. You're going to have it up loud scared.
Not in a shared household,
In the headphones.
Well, I don't have headphones.
You don't have headphones.
Buy me some. So, and my problem was, I'm watching it on Blu-ray and there are no subtitles. No subtitles on a Blu-ray is unforgivable.
Yeah, that is unforgivable.
It's pretty poor.
Yeah.
So I watched it again. I went into iTunes and watched it on Apple TV.
Yes, right.
With subtitles. And in fact, I did it tonight, the second time I watched it, because I just realised there was a whole lot of stuff that was said I just didn't pick up on.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, that version was much more balanced in terms of the sound and the dialogue. So the Blu-ray was pretty poor.
Okay.
And that's why I watched it a second time, because I did want to understand what was happening in terms of all the self-referential stuff about films.
Yes.
I think it's overdone. And in fact, I'm enjoying it more in number two. I fast-forward the snappy bits because I don't know.
You get into it.
But at the moment, I actually don't know. I'm halfway through. I have no idea who the killer is in number two.
Okay.
So I think that's actually a much stronger whodunit. And I'm actually enjoying more the whole thing about sequels.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that's right.
I think that's cleverer and funnier.
It is. But I think number two is very good as well. I still don't think it's as good as the first, but I still think... And I think number three starts to go a little bit off the rails a bit. So I didn't sort of get to number four. It came out in 2011. I was, you know, at that stage.
See, I think I'll watch them, but I will fast forward the stabby bits.
Yes.
But I'm interested in the remainder of the story.
Yeah. But one thing I think Scream does, and this is where it's very difficult when you're trying to make a film like this, you've got to really understand this genre so well. And this is why it's perfect for Wes Craven, because he is such a master of the
genre. And perfect for you, because it's your genre.
It is. And so one thing that this film does so well is get that comedy and the thrills happening at the same time. So I still think the bits are chilling. They are chilling. And the fact that he can go from this is really funny to, oh my God, this is actually really quite spooky.
Mm.
That's quite difficult to do. It's very difficult to do as a director. And that's a director who has to know his genre in order to do that. As a film, I think it's very clever.
I also loved his cameo.
Mm-hmm.
He appears as the janitor.
Yes.
Sometime after the sister of David Arquette tells him, you know, you're not even as important as a janitor.
Yeah.
And then not long afterwards, Wes Craven not only pops up as the janitor in the hallway, he's dressed like Freddy Krueger and he's called Fred.
And he's called Fred.
So I like that. I liked seeing the Fonz,
Henry Winkler
as the principal, but he was a strange character.
He was a very strange character.
Like
actually,
he's doing those weird PA announcements where he says, "And remember, your principal loves you."
Yes.
And therefore, we've got a curfew.
I found that quite odd, actually. He's quite.
Do you notice what he did when you first met him? So Sydney, after the first deaths of Steve, the boyfriend, and the Drew Barrymore character, Casey, I think it is.
Yeah.
And Sydney goes to school. She hears what's happening. And then she gets called to the principal's office.
Yes.
Where she talks to the two police officers, David Arquette and his boss.
Yes.
And when she comes in and sits down, Henry Winkler's character chucks her under the chin like this as she sits down. And it's a bit creepy.
Yeah.
Like he's a strange character.
He's a bit of a strange character. He is.
But I don't understand why he was killed.
Because
the other characters, there was Rash. We can't say why because we don't want to say who Ghostface is.
No.
But you understand why Drew Barrymore and her boyfriend was... By the end, you understand why those two were killed. You understand probably why the next character's killed in the garage.
But you don't understand.
And then it all goes ballistic. I don't understand why the principal was killed. It didn't make sense in that kind of narrative.
Yeah, I understand what you mean there. But it's a horror film and anybody's disposable. Yeah, and they used to just give a good thrill, you know.
This is just probably the weirdest thing I'm going to say in my life, or certainly on this podcast. I like my serial killers to be rational.
You know, I'm going to get a filmmaker from Watch a T-shirt done for Greg. And,
or hashtag rational serial killers. Yeah.
I like my serial killers to be rational.
Well, I do.
Filmmaker, film watcher.
I like my serial killers and my horrific creatures and my ghosts to have an intent. And until 2/3 of the way through Nightmare on Elm Street, I thought that Freddy was going to be totally outside that. And then you do start to understand who is Freddy, what does he want, why is it those kids? That makes sense, but I thought it wasn't going to. And so I was more satisfied with the film that it did that.
Mm.
Ghostface, I understand why those particular characters are killed.
Yes.
I can make guesses about the principle, but I don't quite get it.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And look, you know, I did think all the self-referential stuff was totally overdone. Not totally. I thought it was overdone. However, the two bits that I liked were the last half of the film is all set on one night in this kind of party house.
Yeah, it is.
And the part where the Jamie Kennedy character, Randy, is on the couch watching a Halloween horror film.
Yeah, that's right.
And he's saying, look behind you, behind you, you stupid so-and-so. And meanwhile, we can see through the news van camera
that
he's got Ghostface standing behind him with the knife, just kind of looking at him.
That's right.
So that was funny. And I did like the bit about the fact that the payoff of the fact that the feed from the party house into the van was 30-second delayed.
That was very good.
And what happened there. I won't say any more on that because I don't want to spoil it. But, you know, there were nice touches all the way through this. And I certainly preferred this much more to Nightmare on Elm Street because it was wittier. It didn't have the special effects that really dated. The most dated thing about this film is that they're all surprised someone's got a cell phone.
And also the fact that the Jamie Kennedy character works in a video store and they've all got videos. And it's got... But, you know what, that hard... But when I saw, you know, re-watching that, I just long for the video store again. I was so excited.
I drove past one yesterday. I was so excited.
Did you? Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, they've still got one. I've still seen a couple around. But I long for the video shop.
But you know,
I used to love the video
shop. That
doesn't
date the film in the same way that I think that Freddy's special effects do.
No.
It just says it's a world that we've moved away from.
Away from, yeah.
And, you know, some of the hairstyles are very 90s and so on. But, yeah, the film hasn't dated beyond those kind of, you know, surface things. And it's witty. I think it could be clever in terms of being a whodunit, but you know, you made me stop and think that maybe that's meant to be obvious.
I think it is.
And kind of throw you around a bit. So, okay, I'm fine with that. You know, I don't like nihilism in films, and I think Freddy is quite, Elm Street rather, is a very nihilistic film. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think there's more going on in this.
There is.
And it doesn't have to end with everybody dead. Although whether they survive into Scream 2, 3, 4 is yet to be seen by me. I like this film, but I wouldn't quite call it a horror film. I'd call it a blender genre, one of which is horror.
When this came out in 1996, it was very, very successful. Everybody went and saw it.
Well, not everybody.
No, not everybody. But in my generation, though.
Thanks.
Well, it's true.
And so the true horror comes out.
It was 96. I started uni in 96, you know, so I was 18. So it was the perfect age for me.
The other thing that struck me is there are kind of almost motifs between this and Nightmare on Elm Street. And I don't want to belabor this, but, you know, both films had boyfriends climbing in out of bedroom windows.
They did. And
both of them, central characters, belong to the policeman's family.
Mm-hmm.
So the police weren't this separate authority force. They were actually very much part of that small town community.
Watching Elm Street and Scream together, you all got teenagers, groups of teenagers in a college setting. It feels very samey. And I think Craven does that well. It's the late Wes Craven now. He did pass away in 2015. He made other great films. Like I loved The People Under the Stairs and whatnot. He made that film, which was great as well. But then he made, what was it, A Place?
Places in the Heart.
Places of the Heart. I never saw Places of the
Heart. Which I was
quite
surprised to learn. Yeah.
Yeah, which is, what is it? What's it, just a drama or a music?
It isn't a drama. I haven't seen it. A drama about a music teacher.
About a music teacher, which is interesting.
Who goes around stabbing people, doesn't she?
No.
With violin bows. And she plays the psycho music. Maybe not.
You know, with Meryl Streep doing that.
Meryl Streep needs to do a good horror film.
She hasn't done one, has she? Has she done a horror film?
No. Well, she's done some films that were horrors, but
yeah.
I don't think she's actually done a horror film.
Yeah. Okay, so let's give this a score.
All right, so I gave this 2 out of 10.
That's not true.
That's not true.
That's not true at all. Like, come on, you.
I wanted to scare you.
Yes, yeah. That's
no. I give it a 7.
Okay, great.
I think it does some very interesting things. I would have
Thank
liked.
You.
Oh, I didn't realize you actually made this film. I'm sorry. I would have been kinder. I would have liked the whodunit to be a little bit less obvious, but maybe I've just misunderstood what he was trying to do there. And I did watch all the stabby scenes in the first film, and I was relieved that they weren't gross, because I just don't like that whole, I don't need to see heads severed from bodies and so on.
No,
I enjoyed it. And so no. I'm going to watch the rest of the sequence, as long as it doesn't get too stabby, because I'm interested in where he takes the ideas.
Yeah, that keeps very much in the
same way. And whether the surviving characters all survive or they end up being killers, or what, I've got no idea. I'm curious to see where he takes it.
Yeah, well, good. I'm glad. Well, I'm giving it an 8. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm giving it exactly the same as Nightmare on Elm Street. I think it's on par with that. I mean, I think giving an 8 to Nightmare on Elm Street, yes, it is very sort of nostalgic for me. I've watched it many times and it is a fave. But this here, rewatching this one, I hadn't seen this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it might have dated a bit. I thought, you know, how is it going to be? But I was watching it going, no, this is still very, very good. And the screenplay was great. And I think that's just bolstered up the movie in itself. Started from a very strong base.
So we've just discussed two films by the American horror director, Wes Craven. We're going to shift to something much more local, but mm-hmm. an Australian film that's had quite good reception around the world.
Yeah.
So, Ricardo, why don't you start us off by telling us about The Babadook?
Yeah, so The Babadook. Look, a great directorial debut from Australian director Jennifer Kent. The 2014 film The Babadook centres around Amelia, an amazing performance by Essie Davis, who's a nurse and mother to her troubled 6-year-old son, Samuel, Noah Wiseman. Amelia still struggles to deal with the loss of her husband in a car crash on the way to the hospital to give birth to her son. Samuel struggles with sleep as he keeps seeing monsters. Amelia's lack of sleep and anxiety doesn't help her situation. The mysterious arrival of a pop-up book, The Babadook, about a scary-looking man who knocks 3 times at your door, begins a chilling tale of grief and loss that doesn't leave you. Greg, I'm not going to say too much more about this because I think I really wanted to keep this to the discussion. Firstly, I'm really interested to see what you think about this movie because I think it's directed with a female hand. It's directed very well in terms of it's not just a horror film, that it is essentially a drama about grief and loss.
I understand that horror films can often be used very powerfully to not just be, you know, a scare or a thrill, but actually to carry messages about other issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the moment, and I haven't yet seen it, but at the moment there's a film called, is it Getting Out?
Yes.
American film?
Yes.
Which is a horror film that deals with things to do with race, you know, mm-hmm. and about how black people are treated by white communities, in as much as I understand anything about that film. I think films like The Stepford Wives,
mm-hmm.
which I guess you could call a horror film, maybe it is, but it is talking about the role, the idealised role of women in a very patriarchal society, in a kind of a country club enclave.
Mm.
Which the sequel was nowhere near as good because they tried to make it comic. It was much better, I think, in its original form.
Sure.
And I think that this film does exactly the same thing. Yes, about grief and loss, but also about the pressures to be the wonderful parent
mm-hmm.
when not only do you find it very hard because you're having problems coping, but because the child themselves, particularly in the first half of the film, is a pretty awful child. Mm. And you think, God, how would I go parenting that child?
Yeah.
And to me, there is a superb little moment very early in the film where Samuel, the son, is, being ratty in a supermarket, and there's another woman and her daughter who are just in this one little scene where Samuel says to the other mother, my dad died when I was born. You know, he's in a cemetery, I think he says. And the other mother tries to kind of polish over that and says, oh, but your mother must be, you know, lucky to have you instead or something. And Essie Davis, who is just sublime in this.
And
for those who don't know who she is, if you've seen The Adventures of Miss Fisher, the Franny Fisher character, the flapper, the detective in 1920s Australia, mm-hmm. who's a very, very different character, a much more self-confident, adventurous character.
Mm.
These characters are chalk and cheese, and both chalk done superbly. Yeah.
She is... This performance in this movie, she carries this movie so
well. Oh, she does.
And it's a marvel. It's such an amazing performance.
And in that little moment in the supermarket, she just does like the quickest of looks.
Yep.
And suddenly you get everything. She's basically saying, well, actually, no, I'd rather have my husband.
Quite honestly, I'm I'm astounded that a performance like that doesn't get Oscar nominated.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think if Jackie Weaver can get nominated for Animal Kingdom, Essie Davis could have been nominated for The Babadook. She was astounding in it. It's one of the best performances I've seen on film in a long time.
But I didn't love this film.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the first half was fantastic.
Yeah.
If you asked me to rate the first half of this film, I'd probably give it a 9. Because it was so well done. The build-up to The Babadook that happens, and that you know something's going on. It does something I've seen in other films where the child is intimating something's going on, mm-hmm. but we can't see it. And the mother can't see it, but we know it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
That was very well done. And the moments that the Essie Davis character, Amelia, is trying to get things on track, her friendship with Auntie Claire, I wasn't entirely sure if Auntie Claire was a friend or a relative, but the other woman and her...
Auntie Claire was a sister.
Was she?
Yeah.
I couldn't work out if she was a sister or sister-in-law, just a friend.
Yeah, sister.
So things fall apart with her. There's a guy at work who's obviously interested in her. And trying to...
Comes at the wrong time.
That all falls apart. So Amelia is becoming increasingly isolated.
Mm-hmm.
There's the woman next door, Mrs. something.
Yeah.
The old lady with Parkinson's, whose name escapes me.
Yes.
She, you know, is trying to still bridge things and remembers the husband, which is not always helpful, the husband Oscar. All that was done well. And when you finally see the Babadook on the bedroom ceiling... I literally had that physical sensation, the creeping up and up my spine, the chill, the rising chill, which happens to me usually in a ghost story, not mm-hmm. a monster kind of film, when I am genuinely frightened.
Yes.
Or have that chill. I had it when you saw the Babadook on the roof.
On the roof, yes.
Not long after that, the film for me worked a lot less successfully.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always a problem when you show the monster.
In saying that, I'm going to say the first two-thirds of the movie. So the first act into the second act.
Well, I timed it. The Babadook actually shows pretty much exactly at the halfway mark.
Yeah, right. I'm going to say, the chills sort of stop for me in the last third because you have seen it.
But I don't think there are many surprises left at that point, either. You know where the story's going.
I still think it's quite intentional on the directors.
Jennifer Kent's
to possibly do that. This is where I like the difference here, is that it didn't just go for cheap shots at the end. It actually still kept to the heart of the story to the protagonist, to Essie Davis, and her journey through... her grieving and her loss.
I knew it was coming. It wasn't that I don't want cheap thrills, but up till then there was the developing sense of dread.
Yeah.
And then I didn't have much left. And in fact, there were a few things I didn't understand, like did she pull her tooth out?
Yeah, there were bits like that which I didn't sort of understand. I just thought, okay, she's got a tooth thing going on. I thought it was going to lead to a lot more. When she pulled it out and then it became a nothing thing, I went, oh, okay. Then she starts spewing up.
The black stuff,
which I was going, oh, okay, so that's the Babadook. She's outside of her, but did that have anything to do with the tooth?
When she was eating soup with her son, I think it was, and there was something in hers, I couldn't quite, was a broken glass? What was it in her soup?
Broken glass.
And where did it come from?
I don't know. It was predominantly from the monster. Yeah, they're just little odd bits that didn't make sense. Yeah. The actual pop-up book, though.
Oh, I love a good pop-up book, full stop.
Yes, I know.
And I love the pop-up book element. I thought there'd be a bit more of more story appearing. Like she
did that destroys once, it. Yes, but then
she got more. And I just thought that might keep happening.
That's actually quite chilling. When she gets the pop-up book again, she's destroyed it and she comes back. And then there's more story added to it.
But I knew that would happen because it was so blank. I like the fact that it happened. But I thought
how that's done in that section is so.
Thought that would actually be a part of the developing motif that you'd find out more about the Babadook or what its intent was.
Yeah.
As the story progressed, so she burned it next, and I thought, okay, we'll get a Sins version back, and that'll be more of the story. And I thought that actually could have been continued more, and that would have held my interest more because I'd be thinking, so what's the next part of the story?
Yeah, look, I've seen this film a few times now, and I must say, I felt more like you on the first viewing that when I saw the Babadook and then the chills became less and less so, and I thought it did fall away a bit. Watching it a second time, I got into the story and the grief and the loss aspect a lot more. Nothing disappointed me on the second viewing that much because I'd already been through the spooks and the scares, and they're still spooky and scary on the second viewing as well. I still find them quite creepy, but because I'm looking at this film from her point of view and trying to follow this protagonist, and I'm not watching it for the thrills and chills, I found it a lot better as a film.
I love the design of the film. So we mentioned the pop-up book.
Yeah.
But even her house, the fact that except for the kitchen, everything was this kind of bluey-grey colour.
Yeah.
And to a point where I sort of thought, would you really live in a house where everything was that same shade all the way through?
Cinematography-wise, I think.
Yeah, you know, but it was a beautiful film.
The house is unlike any house I've seen. It reminds me of an American house. I mean, there's not...
With
the room under the stairs and whatnot. It reminds me of very much of an old American sort of style horror movie house, you know?
Yes.
Which I haven't seen in Australia, but
That looked like it was filmed in Adelaide too.
It was shot in South Australia. It was filmed in South Australia.
I like the look of it.
I think it's beautifully shot.
You know, I had quite a strong sense that there was a very assured hand at the tiller of the film, which is Jennifer Kent.
Yeah.
And so then I was curious...
It's a great debut.
..to go back and see that this was her first feature film.
Yeah. You've seen
Monster, have you, the short?
No, I haven't seen
it. Oh, okay, so it was an extra on the Blu-ray I was watching.
Oh, right, okay. You get that on Netflix.
Well, that's for me an interesting point of reflection. Yeah. That as we go from DVDs and Blu-rays to the streaming kind of model, where you get fewer of the extras, so the access to things like, you know, supplementary... films or commentaries will start to go. And I don't always listen to the commentary, but I often watch the extras.
You get them when you buy them on, say, Sometimes. Apple TV. You can get Sometimes. The special feature. They give you extras. But, yeah, that is going, yes.
But I did sit down and watch Monster, the black and white one, and I found it really interesting because not long ago I watched another Australian film called A Month of Sundays about a real estate agent.
Oh, yes.
Who gets a phone call from his dead mother.
Matt Saville film, yeah.
Yeah, Anthony LaPaglia and...
John Clarke.
And the mother is played by that veteran Australian actress, Julia Blake. And I watched that film, and then again there was on the extras, there was an original, I think, 10-minute film.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something quite similar between both these movies. They started off as short films, and the short films were actually the most powerful moments in the big film.
Yeah.
And much more for Month of Sundays, but to a degree with The Babadook, I felt like there was this very powerful idea, so talking to your dead mother or the child's imagined monster coming to life and being seen by the mother... But where I thought they just hadn't quite thought through what happens beyond that. Now, I think particularly in A Month of Sundays, as I said, but even The Babadook, you know, the central idea of the film is that she sees the monster, finally. It looks much more human. It looks like someone, you know, dressed up rather than this kind of scuttling creature that's semi-human.
That one on the ceiling was a lot scarier.
Yes, it was.
In terms of
But in the short, Monster... the film ends where she tells the monster off, and then it lives in the wardrobe, and she feeds it milk.
Yeah,
and there are echoes of that in the feature film. A lot more going on in terms of, you know, the grief and the parenting issues.
That's right.
But I sort of thought, like, because it's the writer who's also the director, and it's launched off this original film, even though the original film was, I think, 2005. So what's that? Not quite 10 years prior.
Yeah,
I just felt like I wanted someone to come in and just. Play with that latter third of it more to kind of follow it through and maybe have said, hey, we could do it more with the pop-up book, because that was a very strong element.
That was a very strong element, because that was quite creepy. And she's beautifully illustrated. I think it was designed by Alex
Juhasz.
I mean, I think the trailer got me really in when I saw that, because it was all about the Babadook, you know. And, you know, the Babadook, I think it's an anagram for a bad book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
But it's so... well done, that pop-up book, and so beautifully illustrated. The bubble book really looks scary in there.
There were moments of just pure, you know, filmic quality. The scenes around her lack of rest and sleep, or falling into sleep from pretty much the ceiling onto the bed, or that she pulls the covers up over her face and then the night's passed. Really captures insomnia. And you understand why that she's just lacking sleep and rest, and why she starts to go off the rails
That anxiety.
But it's not explained to you. It's shown to you in that very filmic kind of way. So there's great stuff happening in
there. Beautiful stuff in there. Very good.
I didn't quite understand why we had to see so much of what was on her TV set. And I know that I think part of what was trying to be communicated is that because she's so cut off from everything else, the TV almost becomes her world. But I there were times when I thought, I think something's been... said to me here, and I'm just not quite getting it.
Look, I always have an issue with... It's something which happens in films a lot at the moment. You know, any time. People are watching films late at night, and they're always a black and white old film. When I turn on the TV late at night now, it's all infomercial. There's no black and white old movies. I can't watch George Melies late at night on television. They wouldn't play that. And I'd love it if they did, but they don't.
Do you have a curious thing about this film? I usually pride myself, if I'm watching a film from Britain, America, or Australia, I usually recognise a lot of the actors.
Yeah.
So I know faces. I may or may not know their name. I couldn't tell you any of these actors, with the exception of her, Essie Davis. I didn't know who anyone else was. The colleagues, the friends, even the next door neighbour, who would be an older Australian actress. Yeah. I would have thought I would have known who she was.
Mm.
The doctor she goes to see. So in a lot of ways, that makes it, and I don't know if this was deliberate, it makes it more real because I'm not looking thinking, oh, that's, you know, Marianne Jones.
Yeah, from that person, yeah.
This is the doctor. This is the next door neighbour. Well, I'm curious if that was deliberate.
Let me tell you, Noah Wiseman, as a little boy, one thing I really just commend the director on in getting a performance out of a child and getting them to do that and obviously doing it and keeping it fun along the way to make the child actor. And you can see sometimes where I'm sure Essie Davis wasn't actually chatting to the child.
Or that swearing at the child
or whatnot. And that was done very well. It would be very hard to direct a child, especially that performance. It really essentially is a two-hander. And he does a very good job.
Again, I'm not entirely sure I would call it a horror film. I think it is, but in a lot of ways, for me, it's a ghost story.
Yeah.
Because the Babadook...
I think it's horror, but...
Well, it's a horror creature, but at other times it feels like it's almost the ghost of the dead father and certainly an externalisation of all her anxieties. Mm. So it's kind of a horror film and kind of a ghost film, kind of something else. But I would certainly commend this.
What would you give this this film, Greg?
I kind of waver between a 7 and an 8.
Yes.
Because, as I say, I thought the first half or so was right up there.
Yeah.
But it stopped working for me. Not entirely, but I just felt like it was a lesser film for that latter part. And I think it could have done some more interesting things. But if for no other reason, Essie Davis' performance, I'll give it an 8 out of 10.
Yeah, yeah, I'm agreeing with you. I'm going a 888 here. I'm going
to... Well, this is not 666.
No, that would have been interesting, wouldn't it?
Not to mention slightly frightening.
Yeah, yeah. I'm giving it an 8 too. You know what? I would have actually given it a 7 on first viewing because I was a bit disappointed with the last third. It didn't sort of go where I wanted it to go. But that's because I think I expected it to go that way. And this is where I think its difference is what makes it better. Following the drama a lot more in the second time, I appreciated it a lot more. So and that sort of put it up a notch for me. So I'm giving it an 8.
So that's horror.
Yeah.
Next episode, we're going to make a complete genre shift from things that are more fantastical and probably not terribly believable. At least I hope they're not believable. And we're going to talk about things that are grounded, maybe shaped, but grounded in reality. And we're going to look at documentaries.
Yeah, I think this is really important. I think it is a genre we haven't really covered.
It's not a genre I actually watch a lot of.
Yeah.
I like stories.
Mm.
But I think these three will be interesting in their own ways, only one of which I've seen so far.
Yeah.
So the one that I've seen before, and only quite recently, is the documentary about Anthony Weiner, the American politician.
Yeah.
That's 2016's Weiner.
Mm-hmm.
And then
they've got the film which I've seen, but you haven't seen, which is the 1995 film by Mohsen Mekhmelboff, the Iranian director Salam Cinema.
Yep, and then the third one, which neither of us has seen, but we've heard good things about, is a very personal documentary by actor-director Sarah Polley from the States, who herself comes from an acting family and has made a documentary about her parents and looking back and drawing on a lot of personal content, anecdotes, old, you know, family home movies.
Yeah.
And this is 2012's Stories We Tell.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to actually chatting about these films in a different way.
And it's a shift.
It's a shift from what we're, obviously this episode.
It's not a genre either of us is particularly wedded or unwedded to. So I think it'll be interesting.
So until next time, thanks for listening again.
Look behind the door, look under your bed, check behind the curtains, and try and get a good night's sleep.